Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we bring you a talk by Ron Chernow from our 1999-2000 season of Portland Arts and Lectures. Chernow has written award-winning and best-selling biographies of George Washington, Ulysses S. Grant, and J.P. Morgan, to name just a few. And his book, Alexander Hamilton, formed the basis for Lin-Manuel Miranda's play of the same name. In this talk, Chernow sets out to humanize the caricature of John D. Rockefeller, America's first billionaire. This is the work, of course, of all biographers, probably of all writers, to fully realize our humanity in all its contradictions. Chernow makes no apologies for a man he refers to as, quote, ruthlessly efficient, but also is willing to engage with the other aspects of his personality. He reveals connections from Rockefeller's childhood to his deathbed and discusses his legacy in business and philanthropy. Along the way, we're treated to a hilariously self-deprecating mini masterclass in writing biography. At a time when there are many signs that we may be returning to another kind of gilded age in which our political, social, and cultural lives may again be dominated by just a few billionaires, it feels important to me to turn back and look carefully at our first in the hands of one of our greatest living biographers. Here's Chernow.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here in Portland. You know, I almost didn't make it into the theater. I saw my name emblazoned on the marquee, which is not exactly a common occurrence if you're a biographer, and I found myself staring up, riveted at this, and finally Julie and a rather powerful team of ladies had to pry me off the pavement. So it's nice to be inside. Now, for those of you who have attended a lot of literary programs over the years, I suspect that by this point you know that biographers are really a rather strange breed, graveyard ghouls who spend their days rummaging among dusty archives and disturbing the slumber of the dead. It may be because decent people won't tolerate us, biographers tend to spend a lot of time socializing with each other. And a few weeks ago, I was having dinner with David McCullough, the wonderful biographer of Harry Truman, and we were talking about the presidential primaries, and David told me about the time years back that he was covering the presidential campaign of Teddy Kennedy. And in the middle of a speech, suddenly a man yelled out, "Teddy, you've never worked a day in your life." And then a man called out from the other side of the hall, "And Teddy, you haven't missed a thing." I agree. Well, this evening I'm going to regale you with some tales of a man who didn't need to work after about the age of 25 or 30, but who managed to work pretty hard in spite of that. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to embroider some themes about the art of biography around these tales so that the evening has the requisite literary dignity. Now, in the sweltering summer of 1855, the 16-year-old John D. Rockefeller tramped the Cleveland streets searching for his first job. He wore a dark suit and a high starched collar, and he later said, "I didn't go into any small establishments. I was after something big." For 6 days a week, for six consecutive weeks, this pale, rather somber-looking boy paced the Cleveland docks until he finally snared a rather modest job as an assistant bookkeeper at a produce commission house. He later said that he was so elated that he actually skipped down the block. Now, nobody, I think it's fair to say, nobody would have predicted that this young man with the long, sallow face would become the richest man in history. He would actually become history's first billionaire, that he would create the largest business empire on earth, the largest philanthropic empire on earth, that his name would actually become synonymous with money itself, that he would be reviled as the country's most ferocious businessman, and that he would trigger a debate about the limits of corporate power that would actually provoke the nation's first antitrust laws and reverberate right down to the present day. Now, having said all that, I'm embarrassed now to confess that when Random House first approached me about doing a biography of Mr. Rockefeller, I thought that it was an absolutely ghastly idea. I've always thought that biography is a little bit like marriage. If you pick the right partner, nothing can go wrong. But If you pick the wrong partner, well, dot, dot, dot. Now, my impression, frankly, of history's first billionaire, to throw out just a few unkind adjectives, I thought that he was boring, mean-spirited, wooden, ruthless, mechanical, curmudgeonly, and empty. And that was just for starters. But my editor is the chief editor of Random House, and I am not by nature masochist. So I sat down and I duly waded through several excruciating biographies of Mr. Rockefeller. I mean, bone-achingly dull books. And these books only seemed to confirm the stereotype that I had of this old gent who went around handing out dimes and looked suspiciously like a mummy in old age. Now, when going through the previous Rockefeller biographies, and believe it or not, there had not been a full-length biography for more than 40 years, I was struck by the almost total absence of any apparent spark of drama. Let me give you a couple of examples. In a famous antitrust case in Chicago in July 1907, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who many of you know later became the first baseball commissioner, Landis fined Standard Oil of Indiana $29 million. Translated into contemporary money, that would come to about $450 million. It was, at the time, the largest fine ever levied against an American corporation. In fact, when informed of the gigantic size of the fine, Mark Twain came up with a memorably bawdy quip. He said that the size of the fine reminded him of the bride's words the morning after the wedding, quote, "I expected it, but didn't suppose it would be so big." You know, Twain is wonderful. In the age of political correctness, you're able to tell an absolutely filthy joke, and as long as it comes from Mark Twain, you're covered. Anyway, when the decision was handed down, Rockefeller, who was an absolute golfing fanatic, he was out on the course, and a messenger boy comes sprinting across the fairway, clutching this little yellow envelope. Rockefeller tips the boy, opens the envelope, reads the verdict, and then he turns to his golfing cronies and says, "Well, shall we go on, gentlemen?" Now, his cronies were no dopes. They read the newspaper. They realized that this little envelope must contain the size of the famous fine. And finally, one of his partners screwed up his courage and said to him very meekly, "How large is it, Mr. Rockefeller?" And Rockefeller said, $29,240,000, the maximum penalty. And then he gestured toward the tee and said, "Will you gentlemen drive?" Now, Rockefeller at the time was 68 years old. He stepped up to the tee, promptly whacked the ball 160 yards down the fairway, maybe a little sublimated anger coming out there. And far from being completely unhinged by this news, as I suspect any normal businessman would have been, Rockefeller recorded his best score ever on the course that day. He completed 9 holes in 53 shots. Clearly a very, very tough customer. Rockefeller had a similarly cryptic reaction in May 1911 when the Supreme Court handed down its famous decision breaking up the Standard Oil Trust on antitrust grounds. To give you some inkling of the globe-straddling scale of this empire, it included the companies that were destined to become Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, Amoco, Conoco, Arco, BP America, Chesbro Pons, and 24 other companies. As our friend Saddam Hussein might have put it, it was the mother of all trusts. When the news came, Rockefeller was again, you guessed it, he was out on the golf course, this time at his 3,500-acre estate north of New York City, and he was golfing with a Catholic priest named Father Lennon. Now, one of many oddities of John D. Rockefeller was that he was actually partial to the company of clergymen. He favored Baptist preachers, but in a pinch, he would settle for a Catholic priest. And on this particular day, he was settling for poor Father Lennon, who quite unexpectedly became a witness to history, because Rockefeller receives the verdict, and he turns to Father Lennon, and he says, "Father Lennon, have you some money?" And the startled priest says, "No, why?" And Rockefeller says to him, "Buy Standard Oil." Now, this turned out to be very prophetic advice. Because as happened after the breakup of the Bell companies in the early 1980s, the stock market, which we all know is never wrong, decided that the individual Standard Oil companies traded separately were worth more than the former holding company. Okay, with the following result. In 1911, when Rockefeller loses the antitrust case, he's worth $300 million. 2 years later, as a direct result of having been unmercifully flogged by the federal government, Mr. Rockefeller is worth $900 million. Losing the case was the greatest windfall of his career. In fact, he made more money during the 2 years after losing the case than he had made during the 41-year existence of the Standard Oil Trust. Now, I always worry in the age of Gates and Buffett when I say $900 million that this will sound like a pittance, a pauper's crust of bread. But before anyone in the audience begins to weep openly for Mr. Rockefeller, let me give you a little historical perspective. In 1913, the entire federal budget was $715 million, so Rockefeller could have paid the entire federal budget. The accumulated national debt of the United States at that point was $1.2 billion. He could have retired single-handedly three-quarters of the national debt. Rockefeller's fortune at that point amounted to more than 2% of the gross national product of the United States, which means that if he were alive today and had the same percentage of GNP, he would be worth $212 billion, or twice as much as the software guy from Seattle. Now, in leafing through the earlier books, there were many, many anecdotes that did testify to a very original and quirky mind. A famous story: in the early 1870s, Rockefeller was inspecting a Standard Oil plant in New York City that filled and sealed 5-gallon tin cans of kerosene for export. Now, in the 19th century, the principal petroleum product was not gasoline for driving. The internal combustion engine had not yet come in. It was kerosene for illumination. That was the basis of Rockefeller's fortune. Kerosene sounds dull now. It was actually quite a revolutionary product at the time because it burned with a very bright, clear, even flame. It turned night into day, and it really liberated the planet from the rhythms of the sun. And Rockefeller had a global monopoly on it. Okay, he's in New York, he's watching a man solder these caps to the cans, and he says to the man, "How many drops of solder do you use on each can?" The man is rather startled, and he says, "40, why?" And Rockefeller says, "Have you ever tried 38? And the man said no, and Rockefeller asked if tests could be performed. Well, it turned out that at 38 drops of solder, a few of the cans still leaked, but none did at 39. So that was promulgated as the new standard at all of Rockefeller's plants. And I can tell you, nothing delighted the Titan more when he was in his 80s than to recount how that one drop of solder, by that point multiplied God knows how many times, had saved him hundreds of thousands of dollars. This was very characteristic of the man. In fact, when he was in his 80s and incomparably the world's richest man, he was staring into the fireplace one night when he said to the butler, "How many inches long are the logs?" And the butler said, "14 inches. Why?" And Rockefeller said, "Have you ever tried 12? Well, he was the master. He had tests performed, and he discovered that at 12 inches, he got all of the light and heat that he needed, but at slightly less expense. See, therefore, the nominal price of admission, I have now given you the secret of how to be a millionaire. Now, despite these admittedly intriguing stories, I was still reluctant to write about Rockefeller. I think that having written about a figure like J.P. Morgan, I was looking for some more conventional color and melodrama. J.P. Morgan was this great kind of flashing, roaring engine of a man. He was the Cyrano of Wall Street. He had this great disfigured ruby red nose. He had a voice that could shatter glass. He had a gaze that was said to be so fierce that the toughest men would be reduced to heaps of quivering jelly by. Morgan, you've probably seen pictures. He smoked cigars that looked like small ballistic missiles. And he went around on a 300-foot steam yacht that was often mistaken for a dreadnought when it would pull into different harbors. Biographers, I think, are all too easily seduced by those people who are expressive, who are demonstrative, and who can be conjured up with that kind of theatrical vividness. I think that we, as a breed, have a secret bias against the subtle, the elusive, and the reticent, and this is perhaps why I didn't initially see the potential in doing Rockefeller. What was actually staring me in the face, I think, was something that was finally much more interesting than the histrionics and theatrical color of a J.P. Morgan. That is, this was a steely man of almost superhuman self-control who had all of this drive and passion that he could keep bottled up even at moments of almost unendurable stress. I, in the meantime, was searching for that most fatal of cliches, the colorful character. And I didn't see that I was really staring at one of the great originals in American history, a figure certainly as terrible and ruthless, but also on many occasions as charitable and wise as any this country has produced. Okay, while I was trying to make the decision, I still had to pacify my by now long-suffering editor at Random House, and I visited a place called the Rockefeller Archive Center on the family estate north of New York, but operated by professional archivists. I think that I can safely say it's the only archive in the world that is housed in a spare mansion and that is decorated with original Marc Chagall watercolors. Anyway, I went up there for the express purpose of getting out of doing this book, and it was a very bizarre day that I spent there because Rockefeller's papers actually had been made public by the family back in 1975. They must have thought that they were throwing one of the great banquets for historians of all time, and then nobody showed up for the feast. So by the time I appeared that day, I mean, here, you know, a bona fide biographer darkens their doorway, and so the curators were not about to let me escape. And as I was trying to wriggle out of doing the book, I said to the director of the archive that I could not write about somebody unless I heard the music of his mind. I needed to hear that inner voice. I didn't hear an inner voice. In fact, I didn't even hear an outer voice. I didn't hear much of a voice at all. So it turned out he did call my bluff, and he called my bluff big time. He trotted out the transcript of an interview that had been privately conducted with Rockefeller between 1917 and 1920, during a period when the family was trying to do an authorized biography that would rebut the great muckraker Ida Tarbell. It turned out that this authorized biography was so sycophantic that even the Rockefellers realized that it was a rather unreal portrait, and they shelved it. In the meantime, here was this 1,700-page transcript that had been done as part of that project, and here was John D. Rockefeller recounting blow by blow every aspect of his career. And suddenly this man who had seemed a voiceless man, miraculously, he had a voice. And what a voice. I encountered, and this is, I think, not unusual in writing biography, I encountered somebody whom I had not met in any of the earlier biographies. Here was a man with a beautiful, dry, Midwestern wit, somebody with an inexhaustible fund of droll stories, somebody who had a very, very canny sense of people and situations, and certainly who had a talent for business analysis that dwarfed anything that I had met with the Morgans or the Warburgs. Were there things that repelled me? Absolutely. Rockefeller could be very sanctimonious. He had a very chilling capacity to rationalize his bad behavior, and he had a very automatic tendency to denigrate his critics even when he was in the wrong. On the other hand, compared to the cold-blooded vampire of myth, Hill was clearly a very intelligent man who seemed to have his quota of redeeming qualities. You know, in the earlier books, whether it was a question of Rockefeller's admirers or detractors, he was often portrayed either as a glorified accountant wringing pennies of savings, or else just as the ruthless robber baron, period. What I could see going through this interview was that here was a man who, in fact, was a self-conscious revolutionary. He saw himself as the prophet of a new economic order that he invariably would refer to as cooperation, and that Teddy Roosevelt and the Trust Busters would invariably refer to as monopoly. This was very frustrating to Rockefeller, and during the 5 years that I spent on the book, I didn't come across a single occasion where the word monopoly passed Rockefeller's lips. He knew that it was loaded. But I could see also that this was potentially biographer's heaven, the idea of taking a figure who was superficially so familiar to posterity and showing that, in fact, he was really unfamiliar. Now, as I began to rummage through Rockefeller's papers, I was certain that I would instantly come up with all sorts of startling historic revelations. All of the secrets of Standard Oil would be laid out like so many jewels before me. nothing doing. Rockefeller's, the letters were baffling. They were elliptical. Here was a man, it turned out, who was as secretive in the privacy of his own home, as secretive in the privacy of his own study as he was in public. You pulled back one veil and there was another veil. You pulled back that veil and there was another veil. You never seemed to actually penetrate the man. He had a very characteristic style of writing letters. He would rewrite every letter about five or six times, and he would squeeze out every extraneous syllable so that the letter expressed one thing and one thing only. The letters were all quite terse, typically two or three lines, seldom longer. And a typical Rockefeller letter was, he was always describing these nameless things in rather vague and inscrutable terms. A typical John D. Letter. Dear sir, received yours of the 25th, would recommend that you proceed with all due caution, signed John D. Rockefeller. And there were, unfortunately, hundreds of thousands of these horrible little letters that he was sending out to his minions around the world. They clearly understood exactly what he was saying. I did not. Now, secrecy was so deeply ingrained in this man that he wrote every letter as if it might someday fall into the hands of a prosecuting attorney, which, for those of you who know the story, was not entirely unwarranted. He founded Standard Oil in Cleveland in 1870, and for the next four decades, he was relentlessly hounded by courts, state legislatures, crusading journalists, and then finally by the trustbusters at the Department of Justice. So he had ample reason to be wary. There were days in doing this book, as I combed through his papers, I felt like I was tracking a ghost through a labyrinth. Even Rockefeller's longtime employees noted this strange ghostly quality to the boss. One of Rockefeller's secretaries said, "Mr. Rockefeller is sly. I never have seen him enter the building or leave it." Another secretary, expressing a very widely held feeling, said, "Mr. Rockefeller is never there, and yet he's always there." He had a way of kind of brooding over the office. Rockefeller had a very slow metabolism. He was much more the Beethoven, shall we say, than the Mozart of American business. Things did not come easily. He moved very slowly. He said that his pulse was about 54. I don't know if that's possible. But he would creep very slowly down the corridor. He would suddenly materialize at your desk. He would politely ask to examine your ledgers, and then he would drift off into the shadow. Among the independent oilmen in western Pennsylvania, Rockefeller was a positively mythic figure, a kind of bogeyman. In fact, mothers in western Pennsylvania oil fields used to lecture their children, "You better be good or Rockefeller will get you." As I said, he was very slow at making decisions. This was a man who would mature his plans typically for weeks or months or even years before taking that first fateful step. And this was a trait, interestingly enough, that first showed up in his boyhood. One of the great pleasures of writing a biography is that you search the childhood for the first fleeting glimmers of the historic personage. And yet in Rockefeller's case, he was a very unremarkable boy who just blended into the crowd. When he became famous years later, many of his teachers couldn't even remember him. They couldn't connect the name to a face. The only thing that really distinguished him or gave a sense of things to come was the way that he played chess and checkers when he was 9 or 10 years old. He played with exceptional caution and discipline, as if he was trying to work out in his mind all of the permutations of the game before he made the first move. He would say, "I'll move just as soon as I get it figured out," he would tell anybody who tried to rush him. He said, "You don't think I'm playing to get beaten, do you?" Well, here we see, indeed, the wizard of Standard Oil in embryonic form. He evidently spent more time at the office sitting on a high stool, staring out the window and thinking than in any other activity. At the daily executive committee meetings of Standard Oil, Rockefeller instituted a policy that the executive committee would only move by consensus or not at all. This was a very cumbersome process. It meant that if there was dissent on the board, that Rockefeller would have to wait sometimes months before winning over the naysayers. But he did that because he felt that that kind of prolonged and systematic deliberation would unearth any hidden weaknesses in a proposal. Anyway, as I plowed through Rockefeller's letters, I was increasingly frustrated. Here I had unrestricted access to arguably the most famous businessman in American history, and I was going nowhere. It was actually my wife, Valerie, who helped me over this hurdle. Now, I should explain, Valerie, a very stoic wife, her lot is not an easy one. She has to read multiple drafts of my long books. And then, into the bargain, I subject her to nightly installments of the research over the dinner table. And one night I was tearing my hair out and I was bemoaning the fact that Rockefeller was so secretive, and I said he was like a master puppeteer and he was manipulating all these people with little tugs and jerks here and there, but I couldn't see the strings. They were invisible. I couldn't figure out how he did it. And I was getting angrier and angrier and going on in this self-pitying vein. And I looked over at her and she was smiling. And I said, "Why are you smiling? I'm looking for sympathy here and you're smiling." And she said to me, rather dreamily, she said, "You know, this is absolutely fascinating what you're describing." And I suddenly stopped and realized it was. I realized doggedly searching for some stereotypical buccaneer. I was trying to put Rockefeller into some preconceived slot, and he wasn't fitting into that. I was committing, I think, the single worst error that a biographer could make. I was not opening myself up to the material. I was not opening myself up to the splendid and implausible originality of life. I was, instead, lusting after the banal. Once I had made that mental shift, the game began to get very interesting because the barriers to writing the story became part of the story, a very important part of the story. Now, suddenly, every day, I was matching my wits against the chess master. I think every biographer probably has the feeling that his or her subject has lived for one of two reasons, either to delight them with copious letters and meticulously kept journals, or to torment them with a carefully concealed life. And Rockefeller was a very extreme case of the latter, and there were many days where I felt that his sole purpose in life had been to torture me on a daily basis 60 years later. So I was determined I was going to catch him at his own game. How did I do this? Well, stymied by the letters that Rockefeller was writing to his associates, I unearthed a lot of the letters that they were writing to him that were eliciting these little one and two line letters. And unlike Rockefeller, his lieutenants were not at all bashful about what they were doing. In fact, they positively gloried in the secret deals that they were crafting with the railroads. They gloried in the wholesale bribery of state legislatures, the crushing of rivals. And the style of play in those days was very, very rough. We're talking about the era before the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. If you were foolish enough in the 1870s to open a refinery in Cleveland, Rockefeller would suddenly guarantee that there were no chemicals on the market for you to do the refining. You suddenly would discover that there was a mysterious shortage of barrels to carry away your oil. You would suddenly discover that there was a mysterious shortage of tank cars to carry your refined oil away by the railroads. He had figured out 1,001 ways to tie the competition up into small knots. But going through his papers, I also saw that we had, certainly if Rockefeller was an example, a very simplistic view of the monopolists of the Gilded Age. They did not invariably control markets by palming off shoddy products on the public at ever more exorbitant prices. In fact, it was clear that Rockefeller was, on the one hand, steadily trying to improve the quality of the product, and on the other hand, constantly lowering the price. In fact, 20 years after he had created Standard Oil, he had driven down the original price of kerosene to a third of its original level. Did he do this because he was Santa Claus? No, he did it because this was actually the most efficient and deadly way for him to hold the market. So unlike some of the earlier biographers, I concluded that here was a man who had made his immense fortune by a combination of methods both fair and foul. And in fact, I think if there's a tragedy to the story, it's that Rockefeller was such a superior businessman that he didn't need to resort to some of the strong-arm tactics he used to dominate the industry. Contrary to his image, Rockefeller was not a dour man. In fact, he was quite a funny and genial character. He loved to sing hymns. He would tell you all sorts of cornball stories. He would even cut a caper or two on the golf course. For 50 years, he was married to Seti Spellman Rockefeller, and he was a very faithful husband, which is saying something, because for the last 15 years of that marriage, she was a very sickly woman and became something of a professional invalid. After she died, curiously enough, Rockefeller developed a roving eye in his 80s and became a certified dirty old man, but that's another story. John and Seti, they had four children. They were absolutely terrified that the children would be corrupted by the money. And they went to extreme and sometimes ludicrous lengths to prevent this. John D. Rockefeller Jr., who was the father of Nelson David Edol, once said that up until the age of eight, he wore only girls' clothing. And was this because it was the style at the time? No. In fact, what happened was he was the youngest of four children. The three older children were all girls, and he was forced to wear hand-me-downs. So everything coming down the pike was a dress. One Christmas, John Sr., who was actually a lighthearted character compared to his wife, John Sr. wanted to buy bicycles for all four children. He'd gotten swept up in this bicycle craze, and his wife said, he said, no, John, we shall buy one bicycle so that the children learn to share. This conversation, mind you, was going on a 1,000-acre estate. There was an appealing egalitarian side to Rockefeller. He much preferred having a conversation with the gardener or the janitor, just some ordinary person. He did not, unlike many wealthy people, use his wealth in order to meet the great and famous and powerful. But behind the cordiality, there was always a certain detachment. Many people who spent the day with John D. Rockefeller came away with the same impression. As they were whisked out the gates at the end of the day, they would suddenly stop and say to themselves, my goodness, he managed to learn everything about me, and I didn't learn anything about him. Now, in the book, being a dutiful biographer, I had to speculate about the source of this secretiveness, and I think that I located it in the very peculiar circumstances of Rockefeller's childhood. Now, some people don't believe that Rockefeller had a childhood. They imagine, because they remember the old newsreels of the old guy, they imagine that he somehow sprang from his mother's womb at age 75 and took it from there. Rockefeller, in fact, was no less the boy wonder of American business than Bill Gates would be today. When Rockefeller was in his 30s, he controlled nearly 90% of all the oil refining in the world. When he was in his 40s, he controlled nearly 90% of all the transportation and marketing of oil as well. And oil was no less the strategic commodity of the industrial age than software would be in our information age. It was the product, it was the industry that was revolutionizing all other products and all other industries. Rockefeller spent his first 13 years in three small towns in upstate New York before his father uprooted the family and moved them to Cleveland. His mother, Eliza, was a very strict, God-fearing woman who introduced John to the Baptist church. He was a very, very devout Baptist, and also she schooled the boy in thrift and discipline and hard work. Her husband's nickname was Devil Bill, and as you might guess from this particular moniker, he was a very different sort from Eliza. He was a very handsome, rugged man, and he was a complete colorful scoundrel. Bill made his living as a fast-talking snake oil salesman selling products to gullible people. He would always, when John was a boy, he would disappear in the middle of the night, he would be gone for weeks at a time, and then he would return always in the middle of the night. We know that when he was out on the road, he would pull into town in his wagon, and he would circulate flyers that said, Dr. William Avery Rockefeller, the celebrated cancer specialist, here for one day only, all cases of cancer cured, unless too far gone, and then can be greatly benefited. Now, clearly, the National Cancer Institute has yet to catch up with some of the findings of Doc Rockefeller. The doc title was, of course, pure hokum, as so much else in the life of William Avery Rockefeller. But if John D., the son, was a curious amalgam of good and bad impulses, it was clearly because he had managed in his own inimitable fashion to blend qualities from these crazily mismatched parents. Doc Rockefeller was obsessed with money. Clearly, he transmitted this obsession to his son. And he also had a very, very jaundiced view of human nature. When John was a boy, they had a game where little John would jump out of his high chair into his father's waiting arms. And one day he jumps out of the high chair, and at the last minute, William Avery Rockefeller drops his arms to his side, letting this little boy crash to the floor. John's flabbergasted. He looks up at his father for an explanation, and Bill is standing over him, wagging his finger, saying, "Remember, never trust anyone completely, not even me." Now, this approach to parenting does not, I assure you, produce well-adjusted little boys. And John was not your, you know, normal, well-rounded little boy. Here was a boy whose father was accused of everything from rape to horse theft and was probably guilty of all of it. And John is a very proud, sensitive boy who quite keenly feels the humiliation of these charges. And so I hypothesized that it was in reaction to what must have been the constant wagging tongues of village gossips that John D. Rockefeller developed this very kind of hard, secretive shell around him. To add insult to injury, when John was a teenager, his father abandoned the family, entered into a bigamous second marriage with a young woman named Margaret Allen, who was only a little bit older than John D. himself. Now, Margaret met him, and he introduced himself, John D.'s father, introduced himself as Dr. William Livingston. They were married for more than 50 years. During the first 48 years of that marriage, she had no idea that her husband's real name was Rockefeller and that he was the father of the world's richest man. I mean, if you could possibly conceive of Bill Gates Sr. living incommunicado, it sounds like a tall tale. And if I were up here, you know, saying this was my first novel, you would probably gently suggest that I take up a less challenging line of work. One of the perils of the biographical enterprise is that certain things are repeated so frequently in earlier books that they that myth and conjecture harden into fact. Hazlitt, the great English critic, said most books are made up of other books, and indeed a lot of biographies are kind of chopped up in reconstituted versions of earlier biographies. The trick of biography, as with any good nonfiction writing, is to take nothing for granted. You start out by wiping the slate clean. In a lot of the earlier biographies, it was constantly repeated that Rockefeller's father had been buried in an unmarked grave in Freeport, Illinois. Well, I got the telephone number of the oldest cemetery in Freeport, Illinois, and I called one morning, and a young man answered, and I said very melodramatically that I was an historian calling from New York and that he had the opportunity to make history. I probably sounded a little bit like a kind of long-distance Regis Philby on the phone. Anyway, he seemed very excited by this. Clearly, this was an unusual occurrence. And I told him that I was searching for the grave of John D. Rockefeller's father and had reason to suspect it was there. And to my amazement, he said, "You know, when I started this job, someone pointed out a Rockefeller grave to me." I said, "Really? Could you find it again?" He said, "I think I could find it again." I was very lucky. It was a slow day at the cemetery, no fresh bodies being brought in. And he agreed to go right out onto the grounds and try to find the tombstone. And before doing it, I said to him, "Listen, when you find it, it may say William Livingston rather than William Rockefeller." He said, "Okay." 20 minutes later, my phone rings in New York, and I hear this young man saying, "Found it." I said, "You did?" He said, "Yes." It turned out he found Dr. William Livingston. He read to me the dates on the tombstone. It also said Margaret Allen Livingston, and the dates exactly corresponded to the dates of Rockefeller's father. So I realized that I had it. Now, here was a mystery that had lingered for a century that had been solved in 20 minutes. And I don't tell you this tale by way of blowing my own horn. Quite the contrary. I tell it by way of illustrating how much can be accomplished through sheer persistence, patience, and insatiable curiosity. Now, I've dwelled on Rockefeller, the character and the hard-driving businessman. He also was one of our most enlightened philanthropists. Here was a man when he was in his mid-40s, about the same age that Bill Gates is today, financed Spelman College in Atlanta to educate black women, many of whom had been born into slavery. When he was in his 50s, he again single-handedly bankrolled the University of Chicago, which he turned almost overnight into a school on a par with the Ivy League colleges. In his 60s, he finances the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, the first institute in the country devoted exclusively to medical research, and it develops a treatment for meningitis and many other diseases. Today, the Rockefeller University in Manhattan. When he's in his 70s, he creates the Rockefeller Sanitary Commission, wipes out 500,000 cases of hookworm in the South, and largely eradicates the disease from the region. In his 70s, he creates the capstone of his philanthropies, the Rockefeller Foundation, which develops a vaccine against yellow fever and pioneers in the formation of public health schools at home and around the world. The scale of his philanthropies was absolutely staggering. I don't know that any philanthropist, unless it was his son John D. Jr., cast a longer shadow than he did. You know, we're living now through an age that's a kind of second gilded age. New technologies are producing new fortunes, new industries, and providing similar opportunities for philanthropy. So I'm going to talk very briefly about Rockefeller's creation of the University of Chicago because I think that it speaks volumes about his philanthropic style. He hired, as the first president, a man named William Rainey Harper, who had dreams that even outstripped Rockefeller's wealth. In fact, it reached the point where Rockefeller had to tell Harper never to talk to him directly about money. He feared Harper's eloquence. And legend has it that when these two devout Baptists knelt together, that Harper would ask the Lord, in a conspicuously loud, ringing voice, for major increases in the university budget. For the first 5 years of the University of Chicago, Rockefeller did not set foot on the campus, and when he did, the effect was electrifying. He got onto a bicycle, and he started whirling through the streets with all of these university administrators furiously pedaling in his wake. The students lined the route, chanting, "John D. Rockefeller, wonderful man, as he gives all his spare change to the U of C." Now, this is very strange. Why hadn't he visited before? I think that he wanted to telegraph the critically important message that he didn't own this university. He was only its founder. As a very conservative businessman, Rockefeller had a horror of fostering dependency among the recipients of his wealth. Unfortunately, such was the magic of his name that in 1910, 18 years after he'd founded the university, he was still footing 90% of the entire budget. Everybody assumed Mr. Moneybags was behind the university. It didn't need their hard-earned cash. So Rockefeller did something very, very daring. He made one last gift to the university, publicly announced it, and then he left it to fend for itself forever. Of course, he held his breath. But luckily, at that point, the people of Chicago recognized this great treasure in their midst and rallied to the school's support. This was his ideal, to set a project in motion, but to allow scope for other people's money and energy. Now, if you read Titan, I'm sure that you'll wonder, as I did on every page of this book, how somebody could have been alternately so angelic and so demonic. Rockefeller saw his life as all of a piece. He said that when he was in a struggling Baptist mission church as a teenager, the preacher said, "Get as much money as you can, get it as honestly as you can, and give it away as wisely as you can." So for Rockefeller, the making of money and giving it away was all part of this one divine circulation of cash. He saw his life as a piece. He didn't see any contradiction between his business practices and his religious principles. In closing, I'd like to read a couple of quotes about Rockefeller from William James. James got to know Rockefeller very well through James's friendship with Charles Strong, a philosopher who also happened to be Rockefeller's son-in-law. Rockefeller did not generally cotton to artistic or intellectual types, so that James's observations are extraordinarily valuable. In January 1904, William James wrote to his brother Henry, the novelist, quote, "Rockefeller, you know, is reputed the richest man in the world, and he certainly is the most powerfully suggestive personality I have ever seen. A man 10 stories deep and to me quite unfathomable. Not a spear of hair on head or face, flexible, cunning, Quakerish, superficially suggestive of naught but goodness and conscientiousness, yet accused of being the greatest villain in business whom our country has produced." On another occasion, James wrote to his wife, Alice, that Rockefeller was so complex, subtle, oily, fierce,
so strongly bad and strongly good a human being. And I like to think that that Rockefeller is my Rockefeller, complex, subtle, oily, fierce, so strongly bad and strongly good a human being. Somebody who was a curious compound of good and bad, all strangely jumbled together. And I think somebody who has mirrored both the best and the worst in our national culture, and hence has inspired a rather passionate ambivalence. Thank you.
Thank you.
We now play Stump the Author.
What leads you to focus on financial history? Very good question. I've gone through three phases of my career. When I got out of school, I had done 2 degrees in English literature. I then worked for a number of years as a freelance magazine writer. And really, I always wanted to write books. I had this naive notion that if I published enough magazine articles and had this whole portfolio, that it would then translate into a book contract. It didn't happen. And so when I was about 32, 33, I dropped out of the writing world and I went to work at a foundation called the 20th Century Fund that did public policy research. I was put in charge of financial policy studies. The great bull market was rampaging on Wall Street. Merger mania was in the air. And I was reading a lot of financial history, and I realized that the old Wall Street was very different from the new Wall Street. And I thought that it would be interesting to do a history that showed how the old Wall Street metamorphosed into the new. And then I got this idea of seeing this entire story through the prism of a single figure or family. It turned out to be the House of Morgan. And I think that I was attracted to that area generally. I mean, after a point, it was one thing leads to another. But I have always been interested in politics and have always felt that business was the kind of unseen and neglected backdrop of politics. And so in the books, I've tried to show the points of intersection where business meets politics meets society. Here's an interesting question. If you could have lived in place of Frederick Gates, how would you and Mr. Rockefeller have gotten along? I should explain for those who haven't read Titan, Frederick T. Gates was the chief philanthropic advisor to John D. Rockefeller. I think that I probably would have done what Gates did. Gates realized that he was going to be the steward of the largest fortune in history. He made a very close study of his patron and quite explicitly appealed to Rockefeller's values. People got along very, very well with Rockefeller if they accepted his controlling nature. That is, I think that if I had done it, I would have adopted Gates' strategy. There was no use either in business or philanthropy opposing Rockefeller. He was a very strong-willed person. But if you were willing to operate within his universe and according to his preferred values, he could be a very, very good boss indeed, who in fact would delegate an enormous amount of authority. Would the breakup of Microsoft make Bill Gates much richer? People sometimes ask me, you know, did Rockefeller deliberately bungle the case? I don't think so, because after all, it was the guilty verdict in the Standard Oil case. It was a repudiation of his entire career. This was his baby, his great creation. And so I'm sure that even though he profited from it, he would rather have had less money and his empire intact. I think that in the event that Microsoft is broken up, I'm sure that it will create a feeding frenzy in the stock market. We'll come up with 1,001 reasons why, you know, three baby bills would be one better than one big bill. And indeed, what can happen with any company that becomes that large and powerful is that it can become rigid and ossified, and it probably would lend a certain dynamism to the pieces separately. Has researching and writing about such incredible wealth changed your attitude or desires toward money? Yes, but I think you'll be surprised by the answers. You know, having written about these very, very rich families, money is a very burdensome thing. It's not clearly in small amounts, but it can, if there's enough of it,
weigh you down. It struck me as very interesting as I got to know the Rockefeller family that in a great many cases when a Rockefeller daughter would marry and then get divorced, she would retain the married name. It was such a relief to be rid of the name. And I have found that in writing about these families, it has left me with no desire to enter into that world, because I think that it's very difficult if you have this kind of all of this money and power and this illustrious history that many of the Rockefeller descendants said, that they constantly have to struggle against a feeling that they're worthless, that just the biological accident of having been born into this family brings all of this wealth, and how do you prove your own worth? How do you establish your own identity? And it's something that they all wrestle with, and if you come from, you know, nice, humble origins, you don't have to worry about that, right? Anyway, on that bleak note, thank you very much.
That was Ron Chernow.
Thank you.
Speaking as part of the 1999-2000 season of Portland Arts and Lectures. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.